Support for today's broadcast comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Zoo Theater Company, the people who brought you Ain't Misbehavin', presenting Stephen Schwartz's Godspell, December 10th, 11th, and 12th at the Virginia Theater in downtown Champaign. Showtimes are 7:30 p.m. Friday and Saturday, with 2:30 p.m. Saturday and Sunday matinees. Tickets available at the Virginia Theater box office, 356-9063. Support for today's broadcast comes in part from the City of Urbana and the Urbana Business Association, presenting The Market in the Square, Saturday mornings starting at 9 a.m. through December 18th, with homegrown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods, and original works of art, located inside Lincoln Square Mall in downtown Urbana. Information at 344-3872.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Frayne, is at the controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we will spend some time talking about the life and work of a man many consider to be America's greatest architect, certainly a very important figure in the history of architecture, and the man we're talking about is Frank Lloyd Wright. In this hour, our guest is Ada Louise Huxtable. She's been writing about architecture for quite a long time. She was, between 1963 and 1982, the architecture critic for the New York Times, and during that time won a Pulitzer Prize for her work. Right at the moment, she is the architecture critic of the Wall Street Journal. And she's the author of a new biography of Wright that is a new contribution to a series of brief biographies that's published by Penguin, and there are a number of them out now. And we have, we here on Focus 580, also on the Afternoon Magazine over the last few years, have talked with a number of the authors of these books. And the book is simply titled Frank Lloyd Wright. It is published by Viking and is certainly available out in the bookstore somewhere near you, along with a number of the other books, biographies of many different figures, just to mention a few: Crazy Horse, Mao Zedong, Rosa Parks, Herman Melville, Woodrow Wilson, Joan of Arc, Leonardo da Vinci, and others. And to that list now has been added the name Frank Lloyd Wright. As we talk with our guest this morning, you certainly are welcome to call. People who are listening are welcome to call with questions and comments. We just ask people to try to be brief so that we can keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone listening is welcome to call. In Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have the toll-free line. That means anywhere you're listening. If it would be a long-distance call, use that number. That's 800-222-9455. Ms. Huxtable, hello.
Hello.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. Something that I think that is true is if we went out and stopped people on the street and asked them, can you name a famous architect, my guess is that Wright's name would come up. And in fact, there probably would be some people that would be the only architect that they could name.
I absolutely agree. He has enormous name recognition.
Now, whether they would recognize a Wright building when they saw it, that's something else. But the name, and I do wonder whether that is, in fact, has a lot to do with the image that he constructed for himself. And if we think of anyone who is the archetypal heroic architect, this is the guy.
Well, he was the first star architect, and he did construct that image, and he did know, he was very wise about the ways of publicity. And I think the film, The Fountainhead, which was supposed to be based on Wright, did a great deal. Gary Cooper played the part, and I think that publicized him enormously and made generations of young women fall in love with him.
Hmm. He was... As you say, he was very skilled in creating an image for himself, and I suppose that the challenge for anyone who would write about him or try to understand him and truly come to understand him is to be able to know both his, as you say early in the book, that he lived two lives, one that he created, one that he lived. So you do have to take some pains to sort out the legend and much of that created by Wright himself, from the real facts of his life.
You've got to know both to understand him, because the research that's been done since the Wright archives were opened about 30 years after his death, the emphasis has been on finding out the true facts, what the lies were, and he was a champion liar, and what the reality of his life was. But if you don't pay attention to what he thought he was, who he thought he was, and what he thought he represented, and why he did it, and you don't understand either the man or the artist.
Yeah, certainly there are some fascinating and scandalous details about the man's private life that you detail, and certainly other people have detailed, and were known in Wright's time. I mean, he was a controversial figure, perhaps for his work and his work habits, but also for his personal life. Some people, I suppose, would argue, they would say, in their interest in getting to know his work, would say something like, I don't want to know. Don't tell me that. All I'm interested is in the buildings, in his approach to design and architecture, and the other stuff doesn't matter to me. And I guess that I'm interested in having you talk about it, having gone through the exercise now of exploring the work and the man for the book, to what extent you cannot separate the personal from the professional.
Well, you've got to know. They are really the same thing. When the mythology tells you that he left a wife and six children in 1909 to go to Europe with the wife of a client, and this was unbelievably shocking at the time, it's all put down to high romance and daring. And it was only partly that. He had reached a dead end in his practice in his famous prairie houses, and he was in contact with everything that was going on in Europe, which was very revolutionary at the time. He was interested in furthering his own career by closer contact, by seeing the buildings. He had a contract for a large publication, the Vossmuth's publication of his work, which he knew would be international publicity, that it would put him on the map. So the departure from the shocking departure from Chicago and the abandonment of his wife and his family was intimately tied up with the fact that he was preoccupied, dedicated to his own career and to realizing what he considered to be his own potential.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suppose that serves to remind one that architecture is a difficult business, in that you have to have clients. You have to have people who are willing to contract and finance the building. It's not like other kinds of artists that can carry on their work in a relatively solitary fashion, with painted canvas or whatever it is that they use. If you're going to build buildings, it's not a small thing, and your contacts with people of influence, people of wealth, are vital, and the better known you are, the more likely it is that you're going to have people approaching you to do the work. So if you're going to get your work, if it's going to be anything more than something drawn on a piece of paper, then all of those other things are inescapable.
Well, that's so true. You have to realize how radical his work was, how strange it was to people at the time. We're talking about the late 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, when people lived very much according to Victorian standards of taste. And he was a real shocker. The houses that he did manage to build, the early ones in Chicago, were referred to by people as harems. They considered them an outrage in the neighborhoods. So that if he couldn't make himself seem very special and convince people that he was an artist and that they should become his clients, he couldn't build at all.
Mm. It does, and I think that not only to get an appreciation for that kind of thing, not only do you have to perhaps see the buildings, it certainly helps, but also to think about the architectural context of the time. And I guess it struck me some years ago. We have a Wright house in Springfield, Illinois, and it struck me as I was touring the house that you can now go there and go through it. And it doesn't seem particularly radical to us now, but I guess I think about the time that it had been built and what the other houses around it must have been like. And I'm certain that some people must have regarded it almost like it had fallen from some other planet, as if a spaceship had landed. It would have been that different from the other buildings that would have been around it.
Yes, it was that different, but I think the reason you felt so comfortable in it now is because it has been so terribly influential. Actually, the ranch house, which is the typical house of the American 20th century, comes directly from Frank Lloyd Wright, from the model that he called a Usonian house that was based on this early prairie house. He cleared away clutter, which the Victorian age was full of. He made a one-story house close to the ground. He turned it into a much more intimate, open environment. He related it to the outdoors. You could step out onto an outside terrace. Everything that we take for granted now comes from what he did then.
You talked a little bit earlier about the fact that he had an identity and an image that he had crafted, and that there are many untruths, many of the things that he said. I guess I'll use the word that you were, he lies about a lot of things. And right from the start, one of the things that he lied about was his birthday.
Oh, he lied about everything that that would contribute to what he wanted to be. He took 2 years off his birth date, which didn't come out until really quite recent scholarship. It made him more precocious. It made him seem more remarkable as an early successful young architect in Chicago. He lied about his education, but he never told small lies. He told big lies. He didn't just fudge his education. He invented it. He really had practically no college at all. He was there for, I think, one semester, and he claimed that he had spent 3.5 years and almost graduated, and that kind of education was useless to anyone as unconventional as he was. And so he ran away. He left at the very end. It was always very dramatic and all done to build up this image of someone who was out of the mainstream, the maverick, the genius.
He was born and grew up in Wisconsin, and then went on to Chicago, and there it was in Chicago where he went to work for Louis Sullivan, who became a very, very important influence. So certainly Wright is anchored in the Midwest. In what ways do you think that shapes his style, and in what ways do you think that Wright, say, if it would have been different, and maybe this is a difficult question, but it would have been different, would have had taken a different approach to design if, for example, he had been born in New York or in Los Angeles?
Oh, he couldn't have been. He's so much a product of his home territory. He always came back to it. The wonderful house, which, alas, is falling apart now, it really needs some kind of a preservation effort. Taliesin, out in Spring Green, Wisconsin, was the ideal of what he believed the bucolic, the farm life to be in that beautiful part of the country which his Welsh family had emigrated to in the 1840s. He was absolutely devoted to it. It gave him a very strong sense of the land and of the attachment that architecture must have for the land. It's an absolutely inescapable part of his personality and his work.
Mm-hmm. He apparently, as a boy, there was maybe there was some concern that he might be a little too artistic and perhaps not masculine enough. So some of his relatively early summers when he was a boy, he spent working on an uncle's farm. And he talks about how hard it was. It was very hard work, and apparently he hated it.
He hated it, and in later years he looked on it with great affection. It was his mother very much, she fostered him as the youthful artist, and then she began to worry that he needed a little toughening up. So he spent those early summers on his uncle's farm and worked so hard. He said they piled tired on tired, but even in his old age he could outwork his young apprentices.
His parents were divorced, and his father left the family when he was relatively young. So for him, his mother was a very, very important influence, and her family also were important.
Oh, very much so. The marriage was extremely unhappy. He was the child of a broken home at a time when, if a woman divorced, she was an outcast. And his mother devoted all of her ambition and energies to seeing that he became an architect. And he was always very loyal to her and the family. And when the split took place, he really felt that he was part of the Lloyd-Jones family from then on.
Well, where does the idea come from to be an architect? Was this something that comes from his mother, or was it something that truly was an interest that just sprang from him?
I think you'd have to ask that of almost any architect. When did you start believing that you wanted to be an architect? When did you feel this? It's my theory that this is in the development of the child, but it was certainly fostered by his mother.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Ada Louise Huxtable. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic. For a number of years, she wrote for the New York Times and is now the architecture critic of the Wall Street Journal, and is the author of a new biography, a brief biography of Frank Lloyd Wright, and that is the title, and it's part of the Penguin Lives series, published. The imprint is Viking, but it's part of the Penguin Group, and joins a number of other brief biographies of interesting folks, so you might seek it out. And also take a look at some of the other books in this series. Questions are certainly welcome, too, if you'd like to call in and talk with our guest. 333-9455, that's for Champaign Urbana listeners. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have someone in Pena calling in here on our line number one. We'll go right there. Hello.
Hello. I'm a very much admirer of Frank Lloyd Wright, and I visited his place in Spring Green, and I was wondering if the school at Spring Green or the school he started out west were still in use as schools. Also, I want to comment, I've read a few times, that occasionally Frank Lloyd Wright would give up a function for design and decorative design, especially in his furniture, which at times seemed uncomfortable, although beautiful. And I have read a few times that his roof leaks. His roofs leaked occasionally. And also, I wonder if the author would mention his visit to Japan and his receiving ideas on design, particularly the overhanging roof that he was famous for, and things of that nature. Thank you.
All right. Well, there's a lot there. You can take whatever that you like and whatever order you like.
Well, there is a lot there. Where should we start? With the Japanese influence?
Well, that would be an interesting place. It's certainly one of the things that we know about him is that he was really fascinated with Japanese design. He was a great collector of woodblock prints for a lot of his life. And you could definitely see some influences, Japanese design influences in his work.
Yes, it was one of the very few influences that he admitted to. Most of the time he claimed that nobody influenced him at all and that everything came from his own special individual imaginative genius. But Japan was a love of his from early on when he was first in Chicago, the 1893 Columbian Exhibition. There was the Ho-Oden, the Japanese pavilion. He went back many times, and you will see the influence of that even in the early houses. His first trip was not to Europe, it was to Japan, I think it was in 1904, and he would disappear into the provinces and come back with works of art, so this was always a love of his. He actually was a dealer in Japanese prints. He couldn't always live by his architecture, and he had thousands of these marvelous prints that the Japanese considered too vulgar. They were 19th century prints, and he bought them for half nothing, but he would sell them. He'd sell them professionally. And he is admittedly very much influenced by Japan, and it's a lovely influence.
And that does come, you think the first influence was indeed from the Columbian Exposition?
That is one. He was a magpie. There was nothing new that he wasn't interested in. The St. Louis Exposition had buildings by the Austrian secessionists, and he went and he studied those over and over again and began to feel, that was when he began to feel he had to get to Europe to really see them. So that there was nothing new, and this is true of almost every architect. They're tuned into what's going on. They're fascinated by it. They want to know more about it. It all feeds into creative work.
Yeah, I think that it's also true that there was among the people we might call the creative class, particularly those of the Northeast at around that time, a great influence in Japan and in East Asia and in the decorative arts.
Yes, it came right from the Victorian age when you began to get the movements that were moving people toward modernism, and Japanism was a very strong influence. You can see it in Art Nouveau. Wright was very much a product of the tastes and the education and the art movements of the 19th century. He was a devotee of Ruskin and William Morris, and those influences lasted till the end of his life. So you see these influences moving through him and becoming something completely original.
Yeah. Just to go to another point that the caller raises, I think that it is fair to say that architecture is equal parts art and engineering, although sometimes when it fails, it is because it's weak on the engineering side. And in fact, Wright has been faulted for that. He did like flat roofs, and flat roofs are notorious for leaking.
Oh, I'm glad he asked that. His roofs didn't leak occasionally. They leaked notoriously. They leaked by many buckets. They would count the number of buckets to say it was a 6-bucket roof or a 10-bucket roof. And the reason is that he was so far ahead of his time, always not only in design, but in technology. Years later, these buildings have been retrofitted with new silicones, with new sealants, with new materials, with state-of-the-art techniques so that it doesn't happen. But there were all kinds of failures, and it wasn't because he was a bad engineer. He was an excellent engineer. A lot of it was intrinsic. Some of it was the little education that he got, and much of it was working with a fine engineer whom he literally picked out of Sullivan's office and carried along with him.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you what, maybe we'll get back to some of the other points that the caller raises. We do have some other callers, and rather than continue to make them wait, let's go on and we'll talk with some others. The next up is someone in Urbana, and that is line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I was just reading a history of the 1920s, and they make it sound like Wright was just a total jerk. I mean, he had 4 children, and he couldn't...
Six.
What's that?
Six.
Six. He couldn't stand any of them, and he ran out on the family. He ran away with a female client of his who was married, either that or the wife of a client, which also didn't do his business any good, and then a house he built burned down 3 times under strange circumstances.
Well, Ms. Huxtable, you want to speak to some of the scandal in Wright's life?
Well,
I have one more comment after that, too.
Yeah, okay, sure. Yeah, go ahead. But go ahead, Ms. Huxtable.
Oh, all right. I think we always seem to want to confuse character with ability. Wright was a scoundrel in many ways, and it was always directed toward getting his work built, toward getting the client, toward convincing the client. He lived a very free and immoral life at a time when it was terribly shocking and very much frowned on. They preached against him from the pulpits of the churches. Today it would be for page 6. It would not be quite so shocking. But it was always because he was his own person, and he was his own person whether it was moral or not. It's not something you can really stand in judgment for. You can say he's a jerk. You can say he's a genius. What ultimately counts is what he did with his life and what he did with his art.
Okay. The other comment?
Yeah.
On the other hand, just to show you the other side, from the person, from the professional side, apparently, when he couldn't get any business in the U.S., his first real big project was the Imperial Palace in Tokyo, where the Japanese government took him on, and He apparently was able, since the soil in Tokyo is very sandy, and I guess in Chicago, where Wright learned his trade, was muddy, he learned to, instead of anchoring the building in the bedrock, since there was none, he would use these big, huge, gargantuan hollow boxes called caissons, or caissons, and literally float the building in the mud or the sand. And that worked just wonderfully for this Imperial Hotel. And I think less than a year later, there was an earthquake, and the whole city burned down except for the hotel. And the reason was that he put in a pool, and they said it cost too much, but he refused to take it out. And it was that pool was and the solid foundation was the only thing that kept this hotel from falling apart, and like half the city was found shelter there, and because of Wright's work. So that's my comment.
Yes, that's a very, very good description of what actually happened. He saved a lot of Japanese lives because they took shelter in the hotel. He learned about the floating caissons during his time in Chicago. He was already well known in Chicago when he got the Imperial Hotel contract, which was negotiated over a number of years. It was demolished in the 1960s. There's part of it in an outdoor museum. But it was not the only building that stood. That was one of his great lies. He claimed that he had a telegram from Baron Okura saying that his was the only building that stood, and it was a tribute to his genius. But there were others that employed similar engineering, but his was the outstanding example.
All right, let's continue. We'll talk with someone else. And callers in Champaign, line number one. Hello.
Did you say one?
Yes, go ahead.
A comment about Wright. My husband, as a young professor at Florida Southern University, was Wright's guide, appointed by the president of the university when he was there building the buildings on campus. My husband speaks highly of him. He was not an egomaniac, as many stories say, and inspired the students, and as you know, got them to literally build the building, to make the bricks and so forth. But my question is, how much influence did Wright's grandfather, the Unitarian minister, have on him? I believe I heard once from an architecture professor that that Wright got the commission for the Unity Temple because his grandfather was well known and was a Unitarian minister.
Ms. Well, Ms. Huxtable, go ahead.
Yes, well, when he went to Chicago, another one of his lies was that he went with no possible prospects. He was just throwing himself into the city, and he was going to make his way and prove who he was. But actually, he had an uncle, Jenkin Lloyd Wright, who was the minister of a very prosperous and socially prominent church there. And he did go to see the construction of the church. He just happened to meet the uncle. And that led, of course, to his acceptance in Chicago society and the first chance he had to meet the kind of clients that he would need, and, in fact, to the meeting with his first wife. He was always very shrewd, very aware of what these things would do. He was also a deeply religious man, and that came from his family and from the Unitarian ministers in it. And he was a man, all of this surface charlatanism, all of this showing off, there was immense integrity, the integrity of the artist who really is primarily interested in what he's doing.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, we will go to another caller, and I believe the next person is someone calling on cell phone, so this is line three. Hello.
Oh, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've always been curious about what happened to Wright's children, and I wonder if you could shed any light on that, and I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
That's a very interesting subject. He had a long and troubled and on-again, off-again relationship with his children, who were devoted to him and deeply upset by the lives they led and how they seem not to matter to him. But his sons and his grandsons became architects. He worked with his son. His Lloyd went to Europe when he ran away. Lloyd left school and came to work on the portfolio drawings with him. He was a very difficult man, and Lloyd was most distressed by the relationship. There would be times when Wright would blame him for everything went wrong, and yet in the end, Lloyd said his love of beauty, his love of architecture all came from his father.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I think I should just again quickly introduce our guest, Ada Louise Huxtable. She is a Pulitzer Prize-winning architecture critic and author of several books. From 1963 until 1982, she was the architecture critic for the New York Times, and it was during the time that she wrote for the paper that she won the Pulitzer. And now she is architecture critic for the Wall Street Journal. She's the author of a new biography of Frank Lloyd Wright that's part of the Penguin Lives series, published by Viking. Out in the bookstore now, I'm sure, if you want to look at it. And questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here, someone listening in Kankakee on our toll-free line. Hello.
Good morning, David Inch.
Yes.
Ada Louise Huxtable. Ada Louise Huxtable, your caller wonders how it is that Frank Lloyd writes houses have such a strong tendency to deteriorate. One wonders if it's design or materials or workmanship or all of these. Houses are often striking, but so difficult to maintain. A beach house on Lake Michigan has recently been lost. In Kankakee, there's the Bradley House. With it, there's a carriage house in sad disrepair. The differences in the main house and the carriage house makes this caller wonder if the carriage house really is his work, but the ephemerality of the structure in architectural times suggests Wright. Your comments, please. Thank you.
Well, I think my first comment would be you're talking about a house that's over 100 years old, and buildings age and deteriorate unless they are maintained. In addition, the comment the answer to a previous caller of why these buildings do deteriorate, in addition to age and lack of maintenance, is that technologically, he was trying to do things that had not yet been invented, and so they were very, very vulnerable. The history of his buildings really is a rush and a competition, really, to keep them alive, to preserve them now.
Well, again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. We talked a little bit earlier about the fact that after having grown up and lived in Wisconsin, he went to Chicago, which was a very important place for the development of architectural style at the time, and was the place for a very important firm. There were a number of them, and he worked for a number of different firms, but perhaps the most important was Adler and Sullivan. And that when Lewis Sullivan met Wright, he apparently saw something in the young man. And of course, for Wright, Sullivan was a very important influence, and he learned a lot by studying Sullivan's style and imitating it, and then going on, obviously, on from there. In what ways was Lewis Sullivan important as a teacher for Wright?
Well, first of all, Wright hadn't realized when he went to Chicago that this would be the most important architect for him to connect with. He worked in a number of other offices first, and then he suddenly understood that the most advanced work was being done in the Adler and Sullivan office. And when he did get the job, and again, he lied and used bravado to get many of these jobs, he and Sullivan bonded instantly. They had a great deal in common. They were both interested in what they thought was the future of American architecture as something that was unique to America, something that should be progressive and would lead us into the future. And they would talk till late at night. They were really very formal with each other. Sullivan never referred to each other by anything except Mr. Wright or Mr. Sullivan, but it was a relationship that was so deep professionally. It meant so much to both of them. And I think it was their basic approach to architecture that brought them together.
And yet this relationship only lasted a few years, and they kind of had a falling out.
because Wright did something that our former caller would, I think, brand him as a jerk. He had married and built a house and moved his bride into the house, and he had done it all with a loan from Sullivan to build the house and a contract that would guarantee him 5 years in the office. And part of the contract was no moonlighting. And because he had very expensive tastes and an increasingly expensive home and family to maintain, he began to moonlight. He began to do what he called bootleg houses. And when Sullivan found out, after all he'd done for him, he was furious. He fired him on the spot.
One of the words that Wright always used to describe his style, his architecture, was organic. And that's something that, again and again, when you read about Wright and his work, that's the phrase that you always see, organic architecture. One that's, in some fashion, grows out of nature and this relationship that human beings have to nature, or the relationship that Wright thought they should have to nature. What exactly does that mean? What does organic architecture mean? And how is that manifest in Wright's work?
Well, it's been defined in so many different ways, and you can really almost make your own definition. But it was his sense of the relationship of a building to the land and the fact that you should use natural materials in a natural way, that things should not be artificial or complicated. And he wanted woods that looked like wood and a building that was open to nature. It was something that really grew out of his background of Ruskin's theories of architecture, and that he pushed into the future. It became a basic belief of many modern architects that once you stripped away all of the complications of the fancy styles of the 19th century, you were left with the relationship of a building to nature and to life.
And yet, at the same time, I don't know that you would really say that his buildings were simple or that his decorative style was simple. It's certainly very distinctive. And this gets us back to one of the questions asked by the earlier caller, because if you see a Wright building and you see it with the furniture that he wanted to see in it, he wanted to have complete control over what the environment looked like. If he had his way, he would have designed the rugs, the tables, the chairs, the light fixtures, everything, the interior finishes, the colors that were used to paint the place. He wanted to have complete control over everything. And I'm sure that if he walked, if you had one of his houses and he walked in and he saw that you had placed some personal object of yours down in the middle of the environment, he might be inclined to pick that thing up and take it away and say, no, this thing doesn't belong in here. I didn't make it to go here. Maybe you can reflect on this idea, first of all, on his decorative style and his ideas about what those interior environments should be like, and the fact that they did seem in some cases to be ideals, stuff that looks beautiful, but you wonder what it would be like to actually live with that and have to sit every day in the chairs that he designed.
You know, you could say that about almost every really talented architect practicing today or at any time. They have a concept, they have a design idea that carries right through. It doesn't stop at the front door, and they want to see that realized. And Wright did go in and move furniture around right in front of his clients, and when they were away, they'd come back and find it put back where he thought it should be. And even an architect today like Richard Meyer out at the Getty, I have watched him moving chairs and lamps when he goes back to visit to be sure they're in the places that he intended them to be. So that is a characteristic, I think, of any really strong architect with a special style. It was often uncomfortable, and he didn't care. He didn't care about comfort. And few architects do. If you tried to go up some of the stairs that are done today where handrails are considered a distraction, I've given up on many of the modern architects' interiors. So he was a dictator. He was a man who insisted on having things his own way. And his clients had to be, I think, either compliant or cooperative or secretly change things around when he left.
What, did he himself live in spaces that were like that, that you would have walked in and said, this is a Frank Lloyd Wright designed space with...
When I walk into those spaces, I want to live there.
You would have been a client?
The Dali Essen East is so beautiful. There is a story that Philip Johnson recently, and he is a very old man now and not well, made a quiet visit to Dali Essen East and said, just let me sit here. Let me just stay in this room. Because what an architect creates for himself is not just a way of advertising his wares. It's the way he wants to live. It's what he believes in. And that's a very beautiful room. It combines furniture of his own design and the objects that he loved, which were Japanese screens and prints, Chinese porcelains, Indian bronzes, all with this marvelously aesthetic eye so that you are constantly surrounded by and infused with the beauty of the place.
Mm. So Wright himself, the spaces where he lived, he lived with his own style.
Oh, yes.
Let's talk with another caller here. As time is starting to grow short, we have someone in a nearby community of Belgium, line 4. Hello.
Yes, good morning, sir, ma'am, sir. I've been to a few of these Wright houses, Dana House in Springfield, Palace in East and West, and Falling Water. And I've noticed that they seem to be breaking down very easily. Some of his designs really stress the materials he used to the point that they really have problems putting them back into shape again. Beams deform, different things. Now, they are old, I understand that. But even given that, they seem that he almost went too far with his materials. And also, in some of his furniture that he deals with, doesn't look very comfortable to sit on. And his sizes, when you walk into the rooms and stuff, they all seem short. And I'm not very tall. I think Mr. Inge would hit his head. You know?
I would like to address that. Take Falling Water. This was such a radical design. It is such a beautiful building, and it was such a radical design that to calculate how to cantilever those trays, which is what the floors really are, like trays on a waiter's fingers, as he put it, to calculate the engineering for that was a completely unconventional thing. It was pre-computer. You could do it in 15 minutes on the computer today and know exactly what the stresses were and how to engineer for them. You couldn't do it then. A lot of it was empirical. And there was a great fight over between the client and Wright over reinforcing whether the engineering was adequate or not. Actually, what did happen was he was not a good man about being where he should be when he was needed, and he would send people from the fellowship to supervise the construction. And a young man from the fellowship was left to make decisions, and the contractor left out essential steel over a bedroom window, so that you had almost immediate deflection of those cantilevers. And now there has been a total retrofitting and reconstruction. The building has been put back into its proper condition. I was lucky enough to spend the last weekend in that house before Edgar Kaufman gave it to the Pennsylvania Conservancy, and doubly lucky to spend the time, the night, in the master bedroom over the waterfall. And it's an experience I've never forgotten. And I think one measures that kind of experience in that kind of house over the difficulty of getting it built and the necessity of taking care of it.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. We are coming down to a point. We have maybe about 7-8 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Ada Louise Huxtable. She is architecture critic for the Wall Street Journal. Before that, for a number of years, also wrote for the New York Times, the author of a new brief biography of Frank Lloyd Wright. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Here's caller, someone on cell phone, line number 1. Hello.
Yes, Ada, I wondered, did Frank Lloyd Wright design the Chrysler Building in New York City?
Did he?
Yes.
No, that was William Van Allen.
All right. I couldn't remember if he did that or not. And also, was his daughter Susan or his granddaughter Susan Hayward?
Anne Bancroft, I think. Now, I may have it wrong, but there is a granddaughter who was a movie actress.
Yes, I think it was Susan Hayward. All right. Well, thank you very much.
All right. We'll go over to another caller. This is someone in Indiana on our line 4. Hello.
Hello. First thing I came to mind when you mentioned the lady and talked about her is that she worked for the New York Times and she worked for the Wall Street Journal. And I can't think of any other situation where you can go from one outstanding, let's say in the broad sense, liberal paper to one outstanding, you know, least capitalistic paper. I was wondering if there's any differences in your approach when you wrote about architecture in either one of the places. Did your editors or whoever was over you require you to say things in certain ways or look at certain buildings or have a particular slant on what you did when you did write?
I hardly know how to answer that because it is such a strange assumption to me. Of course, I've not been affected by where I work. My viewpoint is my own, and I've always been given the dignity and the privilege of expressing it. But I like your thought of the comparison of the two papers. The fact is that the Wall Street Journal, I write for the Leisure and Arts, the Leisure and Arts page, and that is a totally, almost an independent entity with some of the best critics in the country saying exactly they want to say about their subjects. And we're not beholden to any editorial opinion of the paper in either case. That was true.
All right. Let's, again, we'll talk with someone in Indiana. This is a caller in Terre Haute on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes. I wanted to add a couple things. One is Anne Baxter was his granddaughter.
Anne Baxter. Thank
Anne
you.
Anne Baxter. The other thing is I wondered what the academic view of the biography of Wright, A Man of Many Masks, is at this point with new information coming. And then my final comment, for folks in this part of the country, there's a house in West Lafayette, Indiana, designed by Wright. Very late in his practice, it's a Usonian house called Samara. And it's still in the process of being built and finished by the architect's plans by a retired professor who, with his wife, convinced Wright to design this house for them in the early 50s. And there's a foundation now to maintain it and help complete it. It's just a wonderful example of a Wright, not a fabulously neat house like the Dana House or Falling Water or the Robie House, but a very simple house. Wright never saw the site. It was almost by mail, but this gentleman who owns the house and has had this foundation with the Art Museum in Lafayette just loved this place so much, and you could actually go into a house that's being lived in to this day and talk with this man, and it's just a great opportunity to see a different side of Wright. So I'll hang up and listen to your comments about Man of Many Masks. Thank you.
All right. Well, can you do that?
I love ending on that note of continuity and relevance and the fact that the work is still so very much alive.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the book that the caller mentioned?
Well, I just want to say that I'm an architectural historian. I'm not an architect, and I spend a great deal of time reading all this marvelous new research that has come out since the 1980s. The 80s and 90s have been the period of great scholarship on Wright, and I have tried in a short biography to incorporate what that material means in terms of his life and his work, and that's been the challenge and the fun of writing it.
He, in some ways, I think you might look at his career as being almost having two careers, although there were certainly continuities between them. And I guess I'm thinking about the differences between his work when he was younger and his work when he was older. And one of the notable things about Wright is that he did live a long time. He had a very long career. And it's remarkable, as you note in the book, that I think was when he went to Chicago, was the first, I think you said it was the first time he'd ever seen an electric light.
Exactly.
So he
yeah.
goes from that to the point where when he died, we were, it was the space age. So that's his life spanned a remarkable period of history with great changes in technology, certainly. Can you talk a little bit about his work when he was younger, his work when he was older, continuities between that, but also ways in which the older work was perhaps different or an advancement?
It changed constantly. He was always developing. He was always, his vision was changing. He was learning. He was doing new things. You really have three important periods of his life. It was a six-decade practice, and he influenced three centuries. He started in the 19th century. He lived until 1959, and architects today are still discovering things in his work that influenced them.
And are there many cases that, like the one that the caller, last caller, talked about, cases where today someone is building a Wright design building?
Yes, buildings are being constructed now from plans and drawings that he made many years ago by the Taliesin architectural group. The fellowship became a practicing architectural office. They are limited by the fact that the creative imagination, the mind, is no longer there. Wright designed on the spot, made changes on the spot. They are rather dry. They're cut and dried because they rely just on whatever drawings existed, so that there is a vast difference between what Wright designed and built himself and what is being done today.
Hmm. So just to go back to an earlier comment, I wanted to again ask the question, you knowing what you know about Wright, you would have, if you had the opportunity, you would be a client?
I'd be a client. I'd be a terrible client because I couldn't make up my mind among the many architects I admire. I am eclectic in my tastes. I admire any work that is thoughtful and beautiful and conscientious. And I'm glad that I don't have to make that decision.
Well, there's certainly more to be learned about Wright and his life, and you can find out more in the book that we've talked about. So if you're interested in learning more about Wright, you can look for this book. It's titled Frank Lloyd Wright. It is part of the Penguin Lives series published by Viking. Is out now by our guest, Ada Louise Huxtable. She is the architecture critic of the Wall Street Journal. Ms. Huxtable, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. I've enjoyed it so much. I'm talking with everybody who called.
Very good. Well, programming here on WILL is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields has an in-store nutritionist, provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, and supplements, as well as a full deli, coffee bar, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from Horine's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horine's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Tomorrow morning on the show, we'll be talking with Michael Scheuer. He's a former CIA analyst who has authored a book initially that was published anonymously. Now he's actually doing interviews with his name being on the record. The book is titled Imperial Hubris, Why the West is Losing the War on Terror. That's at 10. And then in hour number two, we'll look at the issue of nitrogen pollution in North America. Our guest would be Robert Hoarf. He's David R. Atkinson, Professor of Ecology and Environmental Biology at Cornell University. We are here weekday mornings, 10 to noon, 10 different topics every week, and we always welcome your questions and comments. And right now, we want you to stay tuned because up next, it's the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the program, Juliet Shore will be our guest. She is a sociologist, and we'll talk with her about what's being marketed to children and how it's being marketed to them. We'll also ask about how these marketing efforts are